Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. Today is Wednesday, August 20th, 2014, and this is the 20th episode of the show. You can find the show at theastrologypodcast.com, and you can also listen to us on iTunes by doing a search for the name of the show there. Today I'll be interviewing Austin Coppock, and we'll be taking a look at and discussing his new book titled 36 Faces, The History, Astrology, and Magic of the Decans. So first, before I get started with that, just a brief usual news and announcements section, of which I only have one piece of news, which is that I just finished expanding my Hellenistic course, and the course is now a 10-part course with over 60 hours of audio lectures, and I just added a new lecture on the conditions of bonification and maltreatment to it. So if you're interested in joining the course, I'm raising the price on September 1st. So if you sign up between now and then, which is in the next week and a half, you can get the price for about $100 or so less than what it will be after August is over. So check that out at HellenisticAstrology.com. Okay, so now we move on to the focus of this episode, which is my interview with my good friend Austin Coppock. So Austin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Chris.
And also congratulations, you are the first of, I think the first of my friends to actually do it and to get a book out. And you are now a published and established astrological authority with your first book being on the Decans.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. Thank you for your congratulations.
Yeah, well, I'm both congratulating you and I'm also envious of you since I'm still also working on my long-awaited book. But yours gives me hope that it is possible to finish these things and to get them out there. And I'm also very impressed by your book because you did something, I think, that represents what the new, I don't know, I want to say generation of astrologers. I don't want to make that sound too negative on the older generations. But one thing that your book does is you cover both the techniques of the Decans, but you also cover the history and the philosophy. The first 40 or 50 pages of the book is a full treatment of the Decans starting in the 3rd or 2nd millennium BCE in Egypt and working your way all the way up to the modern period. And I was pretty impressed by the level of scholarship that you actually put into that research in order to give what's otherwise a book that's mainly focused on delineations of each of the deacons when they show up in a natal chart or an electional chart. You actually gave it a nice historical and philosophical context.
Oh, well, I'm glad you enjoyed that. And I think that, I mean, all right, so in that a lot of the book is delineation material or trying to evoke the essence of what each of the Decans is about, I don't know if you can really do that adequately if you don't follow them on their entire journey. You know, there it's a piece of astrology that has, you know, 4,000 years of history. And so that was, I mean, it was integral to my method and it's integral to interpreting the images. You know, if you don't know the context of an image, it doesn't communicate as well with you, right? Like the same image of a man or a woman, you know, holding a jug might mean something really different to a 14th century Italian than it does to a 3rd century BCE Greek, right?
Sure.
And so I wanted to, I guess I really hoped that I could share some of the, I don't know, some of that extra meaning and context and my enthusiasm for that in the history section. And it's reassuring to hear that the scholarship didn't give you a stomach ache, because I was really trying to walk a line between hard scholarship and, you know, sort of super soft gloss over summary. You know, because there are, I do mention a lot of sources, but it's not written in a strict academic format. It's sort of what I hoped was an approachable but still smart and source-heavy summary of what happened, with some interesting threads and journeys. You know, so at least you like it. I've actually been gratified to hear that people have actually been reading the first section. My fear was that half of the astrologers would only read the first section and be angry at me because it wasn't a PhD thesis.
Right.
And that the other astrologers would only read the delineation material and not have any sense of the scope of this stuff or the context or where it comes from or any of that. So, but it sounds like people are actually reading it as intended, which again is reassuring.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the middle ground that you made there between, you know, just a basic astrology text speaking to astrologers and it's only practical versus an academic text or like a PhD dissertation on the Deccans is that you made it a narrative, basically, so that you gave the story, the historical story of the Deccans from the ancient period through to the modern age. And in that, you actually demonstrate pretty persuasively that the history of the Deccans is much richer and much more vibrant and diverse than I think modern astrologers are aware of, since only really one tradition of the Deccans really survived into modern astrology or was used very much. And that's the, I think, the triplicity variant that Alan Leo reintroduced into the West.
Mm-hmm.
But you actually focus on a number of different variants in the Deccans and you draw on different variants in producing your delineations, which I thought was interesting. And that's what makes the historical section so useful, because it actually tells you where you're getting your sources from and what your inspiration is for these delineations.
Yeah, it was an art project in that sense. It was just like a very well-researched art project where, you know, I sat down with as many images as I could for each Deccan. And, you know, not all of the sets are distinct. You know, there are, you know, a lot of the, you know, Renaissance era Deccanic images are pretty similar. Some of them are identical. Some of them are very similar, but not quite identical, but they're done in the same style. But anyway, I sat down with as many as I could and then, you know, tried to see what the common thread was and if there were, you know, in some cases they're different, you know, it's sort of, they're different interpretations of the same thing or the same dynamic. I used the three blind men and an elephant sort of paradigm. Or interpretive model for a lot of it, where it's like, okay, they're pointing at this aspect of this, they're pointing at this, and I tried to see what the planetary rulers might mean. You know, what aspect of what happens in that Deccan are they pointing to? Mm-hmm. And then I tried to figure out when was an image or a delineation actually just a result of misinterpreting or miscopying an earlier text? Because sometimes a puzzling image is actually incisive and brilliant, and you just have to spend the time to unpack it. And sometimes it's difficult because somebody just got the order wrong when they copied it from the last guy, right? And so all of your research and trying to drill down is wasted if you don't recognize those mistakes.
Sure. So let's talk a little bit about, like, what are the Deccans? Let's sort of frame this for people that might not be familiar with it, and then let's talk about how they actually appear in the text in terms of the images. So what is a Deccan from a most simple sort of definition standpoint?
Well, the simplest definition is that the Deccans are the thirds of the signs. And so each sign is 30 degrees, and so the Deccan, means 10, and it's the same deca as in decade, 10 years, or to decimate, to kill every 10th man, and so on. So there are these very neat divisions of the zodiac into 10 degree sections, and they fit perfectly into our 12 sign zodiac.
Okay, so Deccan is a division of the sign of the zodiac, each sign of the zodiac into thirds or into 10 degree segments, and I guess. So the part of your book is maybe we should take it back to the history in terms of where these things originated and then sort of move forward from there. So the Deccans originated in Egypt, and this was originally essentially the earliest form of astrology in Egypt in some sense, right?
Oh, I don't know if earliest form of astrology is too loaded a statement.
Sure.
I mean, they're very old. We see evidence of the Deccans being used and holding a lot of cultural importance in the 22nd or 23rd century BCE on coffin lid texts. So we know that they were important enough in wide enough use and held in high enough regard that they would find their way into the tombs of kings by then, which means that's probably not when they were invented, right? By the time you've got hard evidence of something, it's been around for a while.
Sure.
So, but even that is pretty impressive, considering that we don't have evidence of our beloved horoscopic astrology until well over 2,000 years later than that.
Sure. So we're talking about 2,000 years before people were even really even casting birth charts. The Decans existed as a sort of form of astrology in some sense in Egypt.
Yeah, and I mean, they were like a lot of pre-modern calendrical traditions. You know, there wasn't this utter separation between sacred and secular time, right? They were used to schedule, in a sense, it functioned as a calendar that had 36 weeks in a year. Instead of having, you know, 52-ish 7-day weeks, you have 36 10-day weeks, right? And these fit nicely into your months as well. And each of those sections was generally represented. Each of those sections was represented by a particular god or the image of a god from a particular story. There's a lot of shape changing in Egyptian mythology as well as most mythologies. And so you might see an image of Horus in this particular story where he turns into a half fish or whatever, which is different than Horus as an eagle, right? Mm. And so they had, but yeah, they had both a secular and a sacred use.
For the Decans. And originally they were associated with specific fixed stars.
Yeah, and this is one of the points at which most investigations into the Decans stumble. And it's one that I certainly stumbled at and kind of lay there for a while. You know, it's quite clear that the Decans were originally demarcated by stars in the sky. Mm-hmm. And so people, when they learn this, they're like, oh, well, we have to reconstruct which stars represent which Decans, and then we'll be good to go.
Right.
The problem with this is when you look at the evidence, you know, what archaeological evidence there is, there are 54 different star lists for the Decans, ranging over to almost 2,000 years, and those get sorted into roughly 5 families, and so then your quest for the original just sort of implodes, right? The reason for this is quite simple. The Decans were established to measure the year, the solar cycle. They were used to cut the year into 36, right? And they'd be in the older Egyptian version begins with the beginning of the year, which was for them the summer solstice and the flooding of the Nile, which occurred annually at that time. Right?
Sure.
And so basically, you know, you can pick stars that are roughly 10 degrees apart, and, you know, that all works great. Unfortunately, when you use a system that's fixed star-based and therefore subject to precession, it stops accurately marking the time of year, right? And it's only, you know, we're basically talking about a day every 70 years. Mm-hmm. But when you do a system for, you know, a couple thousand years, you're way off, right? And so, and for that, and for political reasons, and for some other calendrical reasons, the star lists were being revised every couple hundred years. And so that's why you have all of these different star lists. And so one of the great innovations during the Hellenistic period was to staple the Decans to a tropical zodiac. And this doesn't, I don't think that that's always a good idea, right? Because there are pieces of astrology that are entirely dependent on fixed stars to power them. And you shouldn't, you know, assign a tropical degree when that thing's going to drift. But the purpose of the Decans from the beginning was to measure the solar cycle. Actually, but permit me to go a little further back. It's believed that the Decans were originally used, even before they were applied to the year, they were applied to the cycle of day and night. And that while during the day you could use a sundial to tell what time it was, during the night you could have no such thing. Mm-hmm. What you had instead was the rising of stars, which at a particular time of year was predictable. And so if you see, you know, if you see Sothis coming up in the east, then you're like, oh, it's 9 o'clock because it's this time of year. And so this is interesting because this is the, you know, this is part of the original dividing of day into night by the Egyptians, which predates all of the later, their later innovations. And day and night is a sun-earth relationship, right? And then it's the same structure is then applied to the other primary sun-earth relationship, which is the year. So when we're the tropical zodiac, is fantastic for measuring the sun-earth relationship. In fact, that's what produces it. And so the alloying of the decans to the tropical zodiac actually solved all of these horrible problems with precession that meant that there had to be calendar reforms every couple hundred years during the Egyptian phase.
Sure. And so you see that synthesis because the decans originated in a period before the zodiac had even been standardized to 12 signs. And then all of a sudden, after the conquests of Alexander the Great and the onset of the Hellenistic period, you get the zodiac being fully imported into Egypt, and then the Egyptians or whoever's living in Egypt at the time merging the 36 10-degree divisions of the decans into the 12 signs of the zodiac and the sort of unification of the two.
Yeah, it's a very easy remainderless sort of division, right? It's, you know, you've already got 360 degrees, right? Which probably I think there's a case that the 360 degree division of the circle is probably Egyptian influenced in and of itself. In their old yearly calendar, there were 360 days, right? Each decan, 36 decans, each having 10 days, you get 360. And then they added 5 intercalary days, which were special holidays. So the Egyptians were using a 360-based model of a complete cycle for quite a bit before there was, you know, Euclidean geometry. But yeah,
sure.
Anyway, sorry, that was a bit of a side road.
No. And also what's brilliant about something you said earlier about part of the original function, is that they had this astrological function, but also they had this almost purely timekeeping function at night because you could use them in order to tell what time it was for ritual purposes or for the other purposes.
Yeah. Or is it time to go to bed?
Sure. But that's important because the way that in which they were using the decans, which is basically looking at certain decan, looking at which decan or which fixed star was rising over the eastern horizon, which modern astrologers associate with the ascendant, or which was culminating above head at the time, which modern astrologers associate with the midheaven, when that reference point basically of planets rising and culminating and setting is eventually what becomes the 12 houses in the Hellenistic tradition. And so that's why many scholars actually think that the unique contribution that the Egyptians made to what became of Western astrology when it was formulated in the Hellenistic period is that they basically contributed the houses, whereas the Babylonians contributed the zodiac. And once you merge those two together, you get 12 signs of the zodiac with 12 houses each, with a specific rising decan taking place at the moment of the person's birth.
Yeah. It's and the one of the things that we know that the Egyptians did do with the decans is that they used it to time sort of magico-medical procedures, you know, medical procedures that had an element of talismanic or some other sort of magic, right? You know, someone afflicted with the pox is given a ring which has a particular stone and a particular herb, and the favor of a specific god who is said to reside in or at least be accessible through a particular decan is then called down at the appropriate time, and that will be, you know, and that will be the cure for that person. So that's one of the purposes that the decans were put to. And it's interesting because it's like, as with a lot of the Decanic material, it's a fusion of the magical, the astrological, and the very practical.
Sure. So in the Hellenistic period, then, this is when we get the formulation where, as you said, the decans get merged with the zodiac so that each sign gets divided into three 10-degree divisions each. And at this point, we get the introduction of a few different systems. And this is where the point where things are documented well enough, where this is, becomes sort of some of the material that you're drawing on in your delineations in your book, right? The first system being the one that assigns the planets based on descending Chaldean order.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, became the dominant system in what we call traditional astrology, the Greek to Roman to Arabic to medieval Europe to Renaissance Europe to now system.
So let's talk about that a little bit. So how is that system calculated? That's essentially the system that most traditional astrologers associate with, the system that's used in the as one of the five essential dignities, right?
Absolutely.
So how is that calculated?
So the what you call Chaldean order, I've also heard it called Ptolemaic order, is a very simple arrangement of the planets from slowest to fastest, or from fastest to slowest. You know, the terms ascending Chaldean order is fast to slow, and descending Chaldean order, which is what we're using for the decans, is slow to fast. Mm. And so it's a very simple organization of the seven visible planets, starting with Saturn, the slowest, then Jupiter, then Mars, then the Sun, then Venus, then Mercury, then the Moon. And this is found, this is the order in which planetary hours go. It's also the order of Dante's planetary heavens. You see this order on the planetary schemes for the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. It's really one of the fundamental sort of, it's one of the fundamental little orderings of the planets that you should know in astrology, because it's everywhere.
Sure. I thought that was a really compelling point that you made in the introduction, which is that the use of the descending Chaldean order is not just restricted to the decans. So it's not just this weird thing that shows up there, but it's in a bunch of other things, such as the days of the week, as you mentioned, where Monday is associated with the Moon and Tuesday is associated with Mars and Wednesday with Mercury and, what is it, Thursday with Jupiter, so on and so forth.
Right. And so the weekdays are not descending Chaldean order.
Right.
They are produced by the ordering of hours. And it's the ordering of planetary hours that actually produces the days. You know, in such a manner that would be not too hard to illustrate with graphs and charts, but will be a nightmare to do verbally.
Sure. So. Yeah, I think Christopher Warnock has a good article on that that people can look up if you search for like planetary rulers of the hour on his website. You can find a nice diagram that demonstrates that.
Well, and that's although the planetary days and hours system is much more widely discussed in magic or neo-pagan or occult circles these days, you know, it's in you see it in Valens. Valens talks about how to calculate the day and the hour of things. It's absolutely part of the astrological tradition.
Yeah, it's in Paulus as well, and I think it's also talked about in some electional texts. So that's one of the system that's introduced really early in the Hellenistic tradition, because I think it shows up first in Teucer of Babylon, who mm-hmm. I think is usually dated to either the first century BC or the first century CE, which is relatively early in terms of Hellenistic sources. And that became obviously widely used in the later medieval and Renaissance traditions, where they included it in the point system. But that became one of the, I mean, that's a system that you really stand by, or you really think is a valid conceptual construct for accessing or understanding the meaning of each of the decans?
No, I don't. So I think it's interesting, and I don't think it's useless. The point system, you know, the point system.
Oh, you're talking about the point system, but not the. I thought you were rejecting the assignments right now.
No, the Ptolemaic order. No, absolutely not.
Okay.
No, I thought you were talking about the point system.
I thought you were just invalidating your entire book here in a very brief interview.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's all crap.
Right.
That's my mind. No, I do think that descending Ptolemaic order is very useful.
Assignment of the planets to them based on that is good, but not necessarily assigning a numeric value to it.
I think this is actually a big discussion, and that's how well can you translate dignity into a simple point system?
Sure.
And, you know, I do agree that a planet that's in its own sign or domicile will generally have quote unquote more power than a planet in its own decan. But there's a lot of complexity there, and there's some horizontal action as well as some vertical action. But that's another podcast, I think.
Sure, sure. But in terms of your, because one of the things in terms of the structure of the book is you have the history section at the beginning, and then you have a delineation where you discuss, broadly speaking, the meaning of each of the 36 deacons. And then you go into a delineation for when each of those planets is in one of those decans or in a specific decan using the seven traditional planets. And one of the sources that you draw on or one of the things you take into account is just if that planet has any affinity or has any dignity in that decan according to the descending Chaldean order, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's absolutely one of the things I do. Even though a planet, you know, so let's say if we look at Venus in the third decan of Aries, Venus is thought to have rulership over the decan, the third decan of Aries. Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting because it presents one of the cases where the dignity by sign, Venus being in her detriment in Aries, is at odds with the dignity by decan or face, right? Where no, Venus rules this portion of Aries. And so what I find for a lot of those is that Venus isn't good at global Venus stuff, right? Like if you have Venus in an undisputedly powerful position, you have like luxuries and the arts, and a certain social ease and all of these very fundamental Venus things, and they're distributed somewhat globally. Whereas when you have a planet that's dignified in its own face, but not necessarily by sign, or it's contradicted by the sign, it represents a very specific power for Venus. Mm-hmm. And she's really good at doing that one thing, but you don't necessarily have the same sort of global power as if you had like Venus in the middle of Taurus on the midheaven.
Sure, sure. And go ahead.
And that's, yeah, well, I just, yeah, and just to add to that, that's very interesting because speaking about the dignity system, one of the things that really caught my eye was Bonatti's discussion of his description of what the five dignities are like. What do they mean? You know, how can we conceptualize these? And he may have been drawing on earlier sources that I'm not aware of. And he's certainly not the only astrologer who goes about this project of trying to create a metaphor for the entire system of essential dignity. Mm-hmm. But basically he says, okay, so, you know, rulership by domicile is like a king in his castle, right? We've heard that one a million times. Rulership by exaltation is like being a powerful magistrate. In the king's territory, which is interesting. And then rulership by triplicity is like being a citizen in that land where you have rights, goddammit. And then rulership by bound is like being with your family, right? You may not be a citizen in that land, but you're protected by your kin, right?
Okay.
And then he gets down to the decans and he says, oh, this is like having no one and being in a foreign land, but making your way purely by your virtue and skill alone, and forging a reputation like solely from what you can do. And so there's this, it's interesting because it's the only kind of dignity that in this construct that comes from the native themselves. It's not conferred by their national status or their hereditary status or even, you know, their family status. It's a type of dignity that comes from within, right? And so a lot of times what I saw with the Deccans is there's a particular skill. There's a particular ability. A person is particularly facile with it at that one little 36th of life. And that's a different kind of, again, that's a different kind of dignity than being born a king, right? Being an excellent juggler.
Sure, sure.
Right? Or a good astrologer, right? But to make one's way through their skill alone. So.
Sure, that makes sense. And the sort of distinction between maybe one's external circumstances versus some internal trait or quality that you have. And that actually provides a good segue in terms of the title of the book isn't 36 Deccans or 36 Deacons, it's 36 Faces. And I thought that was an interesting and very deliberate choice on your part to use what was essentially the original term for the Deccans, which in addition to in Greek being called Decanoi, they were also referred to with the Greek word prosopon, which means face or countenance. Literally sort of the face or what a person looks like or appears like in their face.
Yeah.
And that's connected to this other stream that was quite apart from the Chaldean order assignments of each of the planets to the Deccan, which was this separate stream, which is that the Deccans are one of the unique parts of astrology because in different traditions, they've had specific illustrations associated with them. And that's also part of what you drew on for your delineations, right?
Absolutely. I think it's huge. One of the unlike virtually any other part of astrology, when you look at texts in which the Deccans are there, the meaning of them is not communicated primarily through the written word. It's communicated through symbolically dense, loaded imagery. Mm. And so whereas the sign Cancer being represented by the crab, that's imagery. Right. But then, you know, when an astrologer goes on to describe what Cancer means, they kind of riff on crab, but really just go off on what Cancer means. Whereas in a lot of astrological texts, you'll have, and magical texts, you'll have the image described, the image described in great detail. And then there'll be a word or two, there'll be a sentence or two about what it means. Right. So let me see if I can find a good example.
Sure.
All right. Well, let's just start with Aries. Right. So Aries 1. Right. In the Aruberos translation of the Arabic Picatrix, we have arising in the first face of Aries, a large and distinguished black man who is mad with red eyes and an axe in his hand, a white rope wrapped around his waist. And so that's a pretty evocative image. Right, we have a lot of different elements there. And it just says this is a phase of cruelty, aggression, haughtiness, and insolence. And so you have a figure. He has mad red eyes. He has an axe in his hand. He has a white rope wrapped around his waist, which is really interesting. And he is both large and distinguished. Right. So there are a lot of questions here. And they're not answered by, cruelty, aggression, haughtiness, and insolence. There's a lot more going on than those things. And that's really emblematic of how the Deccans are communicated throughout most of the history of astrology.
Sure. So the imagery actually carries with it additional subtle symbolic cues and symbolic meaning that unless you have access to that or unless you're paying attention to that, you might overlook important parts of the actual meaning astrologically.
Yeah, I found them to be, I found the Deccans to be far more complex and precise and intriguing than, you know, a sentence of, this is haughtiness and arrogance and being mean. You know, that I found them all to be these, I guess the way that I ended up seeing them was that they were like these, that the portraits of these figures and the gods and angels and demons associated with them, they were almost like, like freeze frames or movie posters from a longer narrative strand, from a particular set of stories. And remembering, of course, that the moving image is something very, very new historically, and that narrative was often something that people who narrative was often portrayed in a single image, you know, pre-20th century. Especially if you look at some of the old masters, you see, you know, they're really trying to capture a dynamic, which would, you know, which is like the key point in a story, which suggests both what came before this and what will come as a consequence of this. Mm-hmm. And so when I spent a lot of time with each Deccan kind of and surrounded myself with the images and just tranced out, it became, they really seem more like movie posters or the works of old masters trying to evoke a whole set of circumstances rather than just, oh, it's a picture of a guy with an axe.
Sure. Yeah, and that was actually your pro. And that's what's, I think, both unique and innovative about your book is that you, is your actual process of coming up with the delineations. What you were attempting to do here is basically take many of the different symbolic imagery from the different descriptions of the Deccans over the past 2,000 years, describe them to a certain extent in the text, but then also synthesize them and produce, I don't want to say like a completely modern delineation, but produce a delineation that makes sense in a modern context that's based on those illustrations and based on the imagery that they're trying to convey.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the intent. It's kind of a compost project. Mm-hmm. Take as much of the past as possible and just let it sit all together and then, you know, see what you can get to grow in that. And so, you know, part of my thought process in when I was writing the book was there, I don't know, I had a concern about the arrogance of adding myself to this list of people who'd interpreted the Deccans.
Sure.
And so I was hesitant about that, and I didn't want to privilege my own delineations over other ones. But the more I researched, I realized that this has been going on for a long time, and that the Deccans have been interpreted and reinterpreted and the images scrutinized and put to different purposes for virtually their entire history. And that it was not too haughty, I think, to basically just, I guess I see it as starting the conversation again by adding, you know, by just offering what I could get out of them in the time that I spent. And one thing that I experienced is that when you really sit down and spend time with the Deccans and you look at their symbols and you also, of course, look at people's charts, especially those that have a Deccanic ruler in a particular place. The understandings that arise from that do tend to be visual. It, for whatever reason, it's a division of the circle, it's a division of reality of the sky that really lends itself to the visual. And I think that probably the best set of symbols that a person can use for the or images that a person can use for the Deccan are those that arise to them after contemplation and study. And so I offer mine, but what I would really like is for the people is for those images to arise organically from people as a result of study and contemplation and practice with the Deccans. So I guess I'm trying to like hand it to other people, and here's my set of interpretations, and we always have to learn on somebody else's. But then once we learn, you know, the system, you know, we grow into that trellis, and it's a little bit different.
Sure. So, I mean, was that part of the process where it wasn't just about thinking about the imagery or thinking about the planetary associations, but also you were thinking about specific examples that you've seen in your personal practice of people with this placement? I mean, because that was one of the things I was curious about as I was reading it, because many of the delineations actually are just like strikingly on target. I think I've sort of remarked this, and definitely my friend Lisa has remarked this, as well, that were just kind of startled by the accuracy or the insight underlying some of the delineations, because I wasn't necessarily expecting that. I was just sort of walking into it like, okay, this will be some interpretation of, you know, these abstract things in astrology that have this very mysterious background. But in fact, no, there's something actually really unique where it's not just carrying forward some out-of-date delineations or brief snippets of interpretation from 2,000 years ago or from 1,000 years ago or what have you, but you've actually contributed some insight of your own to it in terms of how those work out sometimes in practice in a modern setting. And as a result of that, sort of tapped into or was able to tap into something real or something legitimate, something that gets to the heart of the matter when it comes to what that placement means in terms of a person's birth chart or what have you. So it was part of that empirical, or what was your process?
Yeah, part of that was empirical. I would just say, first of all, you know, with the decans, you're literally, you've got an interpretive mandala that is three times as accurate as the signs. And so if you're using it correctly, you should be able to get three times as much detail than if, you know, as using a sign, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's literally cutting things down, to a finer grain. It was a messy dialogue between empiricism and intuition, mm-hmm. right? You know, I would have one thing I experienced when I was writing, because I would write one decan at a time, right? And I would immerse myself in it. Mm-hmm. Is that I would get really overwhelmed. It felt like there was this current of energy or whatever, and my thoughts would turn a certain way and my feelings would turn a certain way. It really, each one impacted me very strongly. And then ideas would come out of that in terms of like, well, what does that look like? And some of it's technical, right? Like, well, Mars in Leo is kind of like this, but then there's this stuff from the decan. So how does that work? You know, there's a combination of formal and informal factors going. And then I'd test it. I'd think about everyone that I knew. I'd look at notable nativities, see if that made any sense or if I was off. And, you know, it's just that kind of back and forth until I had something that seemed solid.
Okay, sure.
And, so, I mean, there's snippets. You know, there's like a solid paragraph. But, you know, I mean, a solid paragraph is not enough for any aspect of astrology. My idea was that this should be enough to get you started. You should be able to kind of feel out what that's like. And I might have nailed a few details. But, like, you know, there's more to it. And the rest is up to the astrologer to figure out.
Sure.
But I at least wanted to get people started.
Yeah, I definitely think you did that. I guess I was just curious. I mean, because this isn't like an L.C. Wheeler 1925 situation with Mark Edmund Jones, where they put a bunch of pieces of papers in a hat and pull them out, and that's like the Sabian symbols. No. This was a lot more involved of a process than that. And you're not just like pulling psychic hits out of the air or something like that, but there's sort of a number of different levels at which you're approaching this, both from a historical standpoint, a textual standpoint, empirical standpoint, as well as others.
Yeah. No, it's not pull out of the air. Although, I mean, if you look at various methods people use for, you know, inducing a trance, right? If anything, I would say that this is sort of, this sounds funny. I think of as a creative or obsessional trance, where you spend a lot of time with everything that you're going to include, in this case, all these decanic images and delineations, and you just soak that up until that's all that's on your mind and you can't think about anything else. And then you're in that place. And then, you know, you look at facts and let your mind run along the courses set by the ingestion of all that material. Mm. And then what comes out will be very much in line with that material. So, yeah, it was very much a combination of creative stuff and pretty careful historical sourcing. And, you know, I do talk about I do talk about, like, here's what I'm thinking, and this is how it relates to this 15th century image, and this is how it relates to this old funny Hellenistic list. And I think that this is what they were getting at here, and this is the relationship between those two things. So I, in a sense, I guess I was filling in the empty space between the historical sources.
Sure. And, I mean, another big component that you deliberately integrated into this and were very careful not to exclude was the connection between the Deccans and the magical or the occult traditions, which you referred to a number of times throughout the book and sort of kept in mind as potential users of the book is those that are using the Deccans for magical purposes, right?
Absolutely. The one of the things that initially got me intrigued about the Deccans was, I don't know, maybe 8-9 plus years ago. I was reading a book on that used a lot of the Golden Dawn's magical system, and they had this synthesis of the Deccans with some of the tarot cards and with a set of angels and a set of devils. And I thought that was really intriguing, and it kind of it made me bookmark the Deccans in my own mind. And although I didn't really get to it for another 7 years or so, it was that wealth of associations that made it, gleam. They made it gleam and intrigued me enough to do a big project. One of the things about the Deccans is that in their very first phase, which is the Egyptian phase, they're represented by pictures of gods. And in the Hellenistic phase of astrology, you have Firmicus Maternus sort of on the sly, after he describes the technical aspects of the Deccans, mentioning that, oh, by the way, there are 36, invincible gods that live in these things, and they can pretty much do whatever they want. And then he literally changes the subject. He's like, yeah, but this isn't the time to talk about that.
Right.
Which is great. He's like, oh, yeah, each of them has three great ministers and blah, blah, blah. But you know what? This isn't really the place. He's a Roman lawyer writing a book for, like, his local Roman overlord.
Right, which he also makes swear to secrecy not to share the book with anyone outside of himself and his sons.
Which is really smart, considering that the empire was about to go Christian, right?
Right, which Firmicus himself was about to go Christian because he converted at some point later in his life and then wrote a diatribe attacking the mystery traditions.
Which... yeah, it makes you wonder how sincere that was.
Curiously, I was just talking to somebody about this the other day, and he doesn't mention astrology. It's like mysteriously absent from his critique. I'm not sure if that's because he never gave it up or he was embarrassed or what, but...
yeah, just best not to bring it up.
Yeah, like with the Deccans.
But anyway, and so the Deccans are also mentioned in the Corpus Hermeticum, and they show up in early, what we would call like... proto-Kabbalistic Jewish magical texts. And so there's this one whole stream with the Deccans is that everybody's sure that they're haunted. And maybe it's gods that live in them, or maybe they're angels, maybe they're devils. The Testament of Solomon sees devils there. And then for the Hellenistic Greeks, they're like, oh, no, it's just a bunch of gods and nymphs and, daimones, and the spirit of truth lives in this one. The spirit of bravery lives in this one. And the daimon of plague is over there. And so you have this whole sort of strand of mythological or spirit associations, right? And if you're in a tradition where you try to work actively with spirits, then that's what you use to set up the timing to approach said spirit, right? And these mythological or spirit assignments also contribute strongly to the image tradition, right? Because each of them suggests an image. I say, oh yeah, that Deccan, that's a nymph. And immediately images spring to mind, images and concepts. And some of those get translated into the later images. One thing you see with, I would say, beginning beginning in the Yavanajataka and more clear in the Brihadjataka and certainly in the Arabic, medieval, and Renaissance periods, is that you don't have that assignment of spirits anymore. You just have images of people, sometimes grotesque, sometimes mixed with, sometimes having animal characteristics, like having an elephant's feet, but you don't have any spirit names or god names associated with the Deccans. And what's interesting about this set of images, which I, in my head, refer to as the godless images, is that they're still considered to be chock full of power. And the way of dealing with them, I think, is most clear in the Picatrix, which is coming out of that that Arabic image magic tradition that you see near the end of the first millennium AD. And basically, the idea is that in these images both have the power to show what is happening and what will happen and what has happened, right? They're reflective, and that's how we use them in astrology. But that these images also have a power to shape reality. And if that image is impressed into the right material, if it's reproduced at the right time, and the timing is obviously based on the decans and the planets, then that those very those images can also bring a situation about, or can teach a person the virtues inherent in that decan. And so I find very interesting the idea that the image has this sort of dual Janus-facing power where it can both reflect and project. And that's really integral to how the decans are treated for a large portion of their history. And so as astrologers, we're interested in how they reflect, but as an astrological magician or whatever word you want to use, there's an interest in how can they, what can they project into the life, and how can they change the shape of the life?
Sure. And to that end, you include actually some statements about certain decans and whether they would be appropriate for certain types of, talismanic rituals and different things based on which planet is placed in them, and whether that would be auspicious or not auspicious for certain types of things.
Yeah, I mean, basically what you can get out of the decans, or what effects they can produce, is based on what planets are occupying them and energizing them. And so there's a system of rulerships, or multiple systems of rulerships, in place. And so, when Mars is in the first decan of Aries, for example, it's very good. It activates the formula of that decan very, very vigorously, perhaps too much so. Whereas if you have the moon in the first decan of Aries, it's a pretty hard place for the moon. None of the significations of that decan are really friendly to the moon at all. Being in a tough survivalist mode where it's you against the world, right? That's not really what the moon favors.
Sure.
And so if you're going to paint the image of the first decan of Aries at a particularly elected time to bring about greater independence and strength and victory and squabbles and all these things that it brings, don't do it when the moon's there, right? That will literally make you vulnerable to all of that. Mm-hmm. And so originally I was just going to stick with the traditional rulers as talismanic possibilities. There are other possibilities, and I wanted to discuss, make it clear that some things are not just not going to work. They're actively bad ideas.
Sure.
you can actually have the reverse of what you want happen to happen. And so, yeah, after the natal delineation, there's a little delineation and a little commentary as to, is this combination any good? What might it be good for?
Okay. Nice. And then finally, in terms of one other thing that's really interesting about your book is the way that you went about doing it and the model that you use, specifically in the context of getting it published and how you ended up producing this book and writing it, which I thought would make for an interesting discussion just in terms of the sort of meta topic about the state of astrological publishing today. So you had a very specific model that you used for publishing this book, right?
I would say that I had the good fortune to luck into a publisher that used a specific model. This is something that I think, as you said, bears discussing, and that is, what is the, you know, where is astrological publishing today? Because the books that are available to us are not merely a function of, you know, what thoughts are swarming the great minds. But what is the, you know, what is the production filter? What gets produced and what doesn't? And publishing in general is in a very strange space. You know, the model that, like the big publisher model, which was dominant 15, 20 years ago, has changed considerably. And a lot of people are self-publishing now. And most, you know, most astrology books are either really watered down because, as in a lot of media industries, you know, in a lot of media industries, the companies only want big hits, big sellers,
right?
It's why you have a lot less independent movies, but you have a ton of super blockbusters, right? In movies, it's either $200 million budget or nothing, right? And publishing is very similar. Where publishers, because they don't have these consistent margins that they used to, want things that are guaranteed, or at least, you know, good bets in terms of, you know, pop appeal, or, you know, or they'll pass.
Sure. And so not willing to take as many risks as before, perhaps.
Yeah. And that's really bad for serious astrology, right? I mean, I certainly benefited from reading Linda Goodman's Sun Signs when I was 20. It's not that it doesn't deserve to exist, but we don't need 400 versions of Linda Goodman's Sun Signs.
Sure. Although that's actually, that you mentioned it, that's really funny, because when you mentioned that just now, that evoked in me the last time I've had the same feeling of, like, wow, that astrologer is really good at drawing out symbolism of a really basic placement, was actually, besides reading your book just today and this week, was actually Linda Goodman's books, because I always was impressed by her delineations of just basic sun signs and how she could get to the heart of some of the underlying mechanics, underlying meanings. So sorry, I just wanted to mention that really briefly.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I did write a sun sign column for 8 years.
Sure.
And it really pushes you to do the very best you can with what you've got, because you've only got this little piece of information. So I do think that I this book benefits from that practice.
That makes a lot of sense.
It's not a sun sign column, but sun sign columns will teach you that as an astrologer.
Yeah, that was really good training, I guess, for what you ended up doing with this book.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and I'm not doing it anymore, but I certainly learned a lot from it.
Yeah, and you are still writing your annual column, which has some elements of that, I guess, right?
The almanac.
Almanac, that's what I meant.
Yeah, it's a little bit different, but I don't do sun sign delineations. I interpret every day the structure of all of the planetary aspects in the order that they occur every day through the filter of planetary days and nights, and do sort of a monthly sequencing. But similar stuff. Back to publishing, right? We probably don't need another Linda Goodman, right? And there are other astrologers who've written good basics books, but there are a lot of really good books at that level. And it's sort of like the basics plus funny is generally what gets published. Like there was the Dark Side Zodiac 10 years ago or something.
All right.
That's the kind of thing that publishers are interested in. And then there are some sort of pop, new age or occult type publishers that, you know, where they also, like, they'll publish something a little bit more serious, but, you know, they want it dumbed down to the sixth grade reading level, and they give writers a terrible deal. And right. I don't want to call out publishing houses here. Just go to Barnes & Noble. You can figure out who it is. But I know that, you know, some of the most thoughtful, respected, and you know, well-written astrologers in our community get totally raw deals from them. So I had the, and so the other option, which other astrologers like the eminent Ben Dykes, who I believe was your last guest.
Oh yeah, the book publishing machine, the Ben Dykes 2000, I think is the name of his model.
Translator,
right? Translator T 2000.
Yeah. And so Ben's gone the self-publishing route, and I've done several almanacs in a self-publishing way, and that's good. But there, and self-publishing it opens up a lot of possibilities for. It opens up a lot of possibilities that just wouldn't be there otherwise. But there are also a lot of limitations with self-publishing. You know, what a traditional publishing house does is they have editors. They'll pay to have art done. They have artists on staff. They have professional layout people. They know how to deal with printers to make sure the margins are perfect. And, you know, there are all of these things that make self-published books look a little rough to the practiced eye, mm-hmm. right? And so one of the things that's really interesting that has emerged primarily in the occult community is sort of a small, just a couple publishing houses that navigate this middle ground where they looked at their material and they said, you know what, this is really serious material. This isn't for Barnes and Noble. This isn't for everyone. Not everybody's going to want this. But the people who are going to want it are going to really value it. And so one of those publishing houses, Three Hands Press, approached me about this book a couple years ago. And it's been a really great experience. You know, basically, like, so that, you know, the whole business model is based on the idea that you're not going to sell 50,000 of these books. It's not for everyone.
Sure.
You know, you plan to have it make business sense to print a couple thousand. Right. And you have and these publishing houses have lists of people who want serious works, who want high quality books and are willing to pay a little bit more for it. And so, you know, because I had the good fortune to work with Three Hands, you know, my book came out in a hardback. You know, when's the last time a serious astrology book got a hardback edition?
Sure, and not just a hardback edition, but also like a deluxe edition as well.
Yeah, there's a limited deluxe hardback with art wraps and a slip case, and it's foil stamped with this beautiful design on the cover. And there are only 108 of those, right? And then we actually did a super fancy edition, and I believe they're called the special edition, where we did one copy for each decan, and that decan and that book has a single decan's artwork as well as some additional stuff printed into it and stamped into it, and so there's only one of those copies for each decan.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And so the idea there is, and this is an idea that comes out of the occult tradition, but I think has meaning beyond it, is the idea that a book can be talismanic, right? When we're looking at the history of talismans, like astrological talismans, you don't draw the image of the decan on just anything. You get exactly the right materials, the materials that correspond to the nature of the power you want there, and you do it at the right time, and it matters. The physical thing is an anchor for the non-physical part of it. And, you know, this is the idea of the magical book, right, which is seeded throughout our culture in both, you know, in fairy tale and legend as well as more serious contexts. And so I really like that idea. You know, there's some books that you read once and throw away, but if a book is not of that nature, if it's something that is hopefully more permanent, you want its physical housing to be more permanent. And, you know, I think that I would love to see an astrological publishing house take up a similar model, and you know, and realize that you know the way forward isn't necessarily selling 8 million ebooks for $2, right? And that it's okay not to be it's okay to not be popular. Some things, you know, for example, most people, even if PhD theses were free, you could just get them sent to your house. There would be, you know, there'd be a couple of us who would love that, but most people wouldn't read them. That's not what they're for, right? You know, and the deeper you get into any area of knowledge, the less popular it's going to be. And so we need to account for that. And I'd like to see more books written for the intermediate and advanced astrologer. You know, we have this sort of weird pyramid right now, which has this giant fat bottom and this tiny little column, this little tower projecting up from that. There's not enough middle ground.
Sure. And also, I mean, the other thing is, what's interesting about that model is that with this smaller publishing house that you went with, the book was actually given the level of respect and care that it deserved. And you received, you know, a beautiful set of illustrations for each of the 36 decans by a professional artist who sort of specialized in that kind of occult, drawing and symbolism, right?
Yeah. That was one of the most exciting parts was, it came down to the question of, okay, Austin, what kind of illustrations do you want? You know, the publisher was going to cover the illustrations and had an artist in mind. And so, you know, I came up with some images, very simple images, and then the artist was sent these very simple images. I tried to sort of boil down the symbolism, right? For Aries 1, where we talked about the red, you know, the madman with the red eyes and the axe and all these other details. I was like, just draw me an axe. I was like, I just want a double-sided axe. And then he was left to embroider that emblem as he will. And so he was sent just that one image, that one simple image with the delineation text, and he just made them all come alive. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. All of the detail is stuff that he got from the text and then interpreted in his own style. And some of them are his own additions, many of which are just exactly right on. And so that was sort of a test case for the idea that the decans speak visually, and if somebody sits down and concentrates on them, they'll start getting their own ideas, which lend themselves to visual expression. But yeah, that was something that wouldn't have happened if I had to self-publish. That would have been a lot of money to lay out. I didn't know who the artist was. It's a fellow named Bob Eames. But the publisher had that connection and that relationship and was able to put some capital aside to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And I think it really enhances the book.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely brings some of your descriptions and delineations alive. But yeah, that's definitely, because that's something I've been really focused on and sort of struggling with, where I go back and forth between those two extremes where, you know, publishing and the major astrology publishing houses are still there. They're not publishing as much as they used to. And the astrology sections in bookstores like Barnes & Noble or even local ones has shrunk considerably over the course of the past decade or two since I've been in astrology. But it's like that's still like an option to go with the big publishing house, but then you basically make nothing, but your book theoretically gets wider distribution. But then the other option is to self-publish through one of these print-on-demand places, which a lot of astrologers are now flocking to, such as Benjamin Dykes, and some of them that are very, you know, self-willed and able to like teach themselves all of the necessary skills and everything else and to promote themselves, such as Benjamin Dykes, are being very successful with that model. But what you've done here with this book is interesting because it presents a third model that I don't think that anyone has sort of realized existed as a possibility yet, but it opens up some interesting options for people like myself or other people that are in the position of trying to decide between those two extremes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice because it seems like a really good answer to the present. With the kind of books that we're trying to do. And, you know, part of the decision to go with this publisher was based on the kind of project it is, you know. it doesn't make sense to do like beautiful hardcovers for my annual almanac, because it might be interesting to look back at my 2012 almanac, but that's not really what it's for.
Sure.
Right. It's, you know, it's really, it's for this year, and then you might not throw it away, but you don't need a beautiful edition on your bookcase. But if you're doing something that you hope might be a semi-permanent edition, permanent addition to what astrologers are doing, you know, or like Ben's stuff, for example, like I would love to have like a fancy Benatti. I would love to have like a Benatti shelf with beautiful books that are going to last for a couple hundred years, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, for certain projects, it makes tons of sense. And I think that, you know, people are willing to pay for quality under the right circumstances. I don't necessarily need the beautiful edition of Linda Goodman's Sun Signs. But yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, I think that's a great model. And on that note, I mean, I think that brings us to the end of our hour. So did you have any other, I certainly wanted to mention your website, which is austincopic.com, and people can order your book from, signed copies of your book from your website, which is austincopic.com. And they can also order the paperback from, your publisher, which is at threehandspress.com. And I'll have links to those in the website.
Yeah, actually, both all three editions are available through both me and my publisher, but he can't sign them for me.
Okay.
So, I offer the signed editions at no additional charge,
nice.
Which is hopefully not some terrible statement about my own value. I just can't bring myself to charge for it. But yeah, the super special 36 were pre-sold 4 months ago. But there's still some of the deluxes available, and there's certainly hardbacks and paperbacks available.
Okay. Excellent. And I'll put links to access both of those websites, both your website and the publisher's website, in the description page for this episode on theastrologypodcast.com. So if anyone's listening to this, they can find those links there. Do you have any other things to mention? I guess you'll be making an appearance at the ESAR conference next month, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'll be at the Esoteric Book Conference at the beginning of September. So in a little bit more than 2 weeks.
Oh, in Seattle.
And then I'll be in ESAR at the end of the month.
Okay. So you can catch Austin in Seattle at the Esoteric Book Conference in early September, or at the International Society for Astrological Research Conference in Phoenix at the end of September. And he'll be obviously signing copies of his book. All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show. Congratulations on the book, and nice work. Congratulations on getting it done and making a big substantive contribution to the history of astrology. I mean, this is, I think, one of the first books, if not the first book in the history of astrology, that's focused solely on the decans, at least in terms of books that have survived. So it's kind of a landmark book in that sense as well. And I'm sure that it will probably become a classic book that most astrologers, or all astrologers, end up wanting to own or sort of needing to own. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. Those are certainly lovely possibilities.
I think it's more than a possibility at this point, but we'll see how things go. So definitely everybody check out the book and make an order it. And then you can let us know in the comments section what you think of it, or post reviews or what have you.
Yeah, please do. Please do.
Okay.
Feedback is gold.
Excellent. All right. Well, that's it for this episode of the Astrology Podcast. So thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode, then please be sure to rate it on iTunes if you're listening to it there, and give it a 5-star rating. You can also subscribe to the show through the subscribe button in the sidebar of the main page. So make sure you do that if you want to listen to and receive announcements of future episodes. And that's it for this time. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.